Thanks for joining us once again on Core Ideas, a podcast where we delve into all things related to lake sediments. As always, my name is Adam Jaziorski, joined with my good friend, Josh Steampont.
Hey, what's up?
So, I think it's time to start a new arc. We've wrapped up contagious ideas.
Yeah. I think
pandemic is not wrapped up.
No. I think many of our listeners probably would you know, may have enjoyed some of the, are they digressions or different topics? But it may be time, tangents for sure. It may be time to go back to something a little bit more directly related to paleolimnology, though.
So, transfer functions part two?
Transfer functions part, yeah. Reconstructions deconstructed again, yeah. No, we'll get back to that. We'll get back to those more technical topics in a little bit. But I think maybe we should not get so quickly into the details. Let's have a little bit more of a general discussion about paleolimnology and where it came from, maybe.
Okay.
Can we do that in one episode?
Well, of course we could. It would just be a several hour long episode. So probably best not to. Okay. And slice it up in over a couple of weeks. Mm. And because one of my, I guess we're very close to the start of the school year, new semester, and one of the traditions, at least in the Pearl Lab, is that John gives his talk, A Brief History of Paleolimnology, where he gives some background to the new graduate students joining the lab.
Which he first put together, I think, as a conference presentation for the PALS, one of the very first PALS conferences?
I think it might actually be the very first one.
Yeah. So, he has this long, not long, but this detailed history of paleolimnology that he has a nice slideshow deck associated with. And I've seen it a bunch of times and always enjoy it. Yeah, happily. having access to him, we have access to it. And therefore, saddle up. It's time for part one of History of Paleolimnology.
Yeah, so again, laying it all out there, we used his slide and his talk as the basis of what we think will be a short series of episodes. Not sure exactly how many it will be, but we're allowed to go in a little bit more detail and explore tangents as we are wont to do on this show.
Yeah, exactly.
And I think the place to begin is, where is the beginning? It's a really ambiguous question, but an interesting one. At what point does a field of science become its own thing? Like, where is the starting point for paleolimnology?
That's a really tough question. Yeah. I mean, for some sciences, that's probably a little bit more straightforward to define. The starting of physics, modern physics, you could pick. Starting of modern chemistry, even, where, you know, you could have those discussions. But when you have a synthetic science like paleolimnology, where do you draw the line? That's a tough one to think about. Let's start with, what is paleolimnology? What are we trying to find the beginning of? Remind ourselves where we're going.
Okay. So for those new to this show, we've defined paleolimnology a couple places in a couple different shows and on the website. And we use the definition, paleolimnology is the interdisciplinary science that reconstructs the paleo environments of inland waters. So basically using lake sediments to reconstruct the ecological or chemical or physical history of lakes going back in time. And so there are a couple different angles in terms of, where does paleolimnology start? Like, one kind of surface answer would be, it starts whenever the lake was formed. And that can be quite a variable number. So in places that were glaciated, you know, the sediment record starts approximately 10,000 years ago.
Yeah, you could think of it as almost the geological definition of the origin of paleolimnology, going back to when the stratigraphic records started to stratify and started to build up. That's an argument. But that's not maybe the most useful for, you know, our perspective of trying to study the lakes, if you go back 10,000 years plus in some locations, it's not really the, you know, the way in which you can start to discuss what's going on in that location. So I think that's an interesting start, but not nuanced enough.
No, there weren't too many cave person paleolimnologists, let's say.
No, probably not that many. I mean, you never know. Until our time machines are ready, we won't be positive, but I think we can say that that's likely.
All right, then. Another angle would be looking at, as we talked about in our secret societies, our scientific societies episode, when the International Paleolimnology Association came into being, and it adopted its formal constitution in 2006 at the 10th International Paleolimnology Symposium, funnily enough. That took place in Duluth, Minnesota.
In Duluth, Minnesota. Well, nothing can be formed in Duluth, Minnesota. So I don't know that we can, in terms of the origin of the science. But I'm not sure we can define the beginning of paleolimnology as occurring after both of us started studying it. So I think that's a little too recent. We got to find something in between 10,000 years and 14 years. We've got a good range there, so we can figure something out. We'll get there. Let's keep working.
Okay. We've also done an episode on journals. Hmm. So the Journal of Paleolimnology released issue 1 of volume 1 in July 1988. Okay. I don't think you were studying it then. Were you born yet?
I was 3.5 years old. So that solves that problem. Adam was a little bit older. But we do know some people who were studying paleolimnology. We were going to try, for example, we're using some of his slides. And we're going to try and get him on the podcast in not too distant future. So I think we could just use the same thing, but from John's perspective, and say, you can't start something after you've already been doing it. So we gotta go further back.
All right, then. So, making this difficult. Yeah. So the science, I guess, would theoretically predate the journal. If there's interest in forming a journal.
That's a good point, too.
Dedicated to it. And if the association was formed at the 10th International Paleolimnology Symposium, how about we use the first International Paleolimnology Symposium as our starting point? And it took place in 1967 in Tehany, Hungary.
I think we're getting closer. I think that's not a bad place to start. You might be able to find people who would make that argument that that's the case. But I would say that your statement about the journal kind of needing to have enough people working in that topic to form a journal probably applies to a meeting as well. If you don't have enough paleolimnologists, how do you have a paleolimnology meeting? So it's got to be earlier than that. But how much earlier? When? Where do we start?
I don't know. Like, you're shooting all my ideas down. We want to establish real beginning, but how far back do you want to take it? Because it's where, you know, paleo brings together all kinds of disciplines. I'm talking like microscopy, taxonomy, sedimentology, dating, the actual mechanics of retrieving sediment cores, all sorts of mathy stuff that I only kind of understand. And a lot of these things were developed simultaneously, cross-pollinating each other. Where do we go?
I don't know. I thought I was here to shoot down your ideas, not necessarily to come up with them on my own.
All right. Okay.
Okay. I'll help a little bit. How about we think about the pieces of that you just described? Like, if we have to have paleolimnology, we need to have limnology first, do we not? So what about that? Where do we get from that idea? Yeah.
No, I think that's a fair point. So paleolimnology is a subdiscipline of limnology, along with some sedimentary processes and other things related to sedimentation. And limnology, in turn, is built on various strands of physics, chemistry, and biology. I think we're just going to say, fuck it. For the purposes of establishing a relevant starting point, we got to go back to the beginning of modern science. And then working backwards isn't working. Let's work forwards. And we'll start.
Okay. That's a good idea. So we know before 1967, probably a fair bit before that.
And after 10,000 years ago.
And since 10,000. Okay. So we got a bit of time we need to fill in there. But that's a start. We got to start somewhere.
So a new place to start. How about we jump, through, the Middle Ages, medieval times, kind of into the Renaissance period, when science was kind of starting, when we're getting into the real conflicts with, the literal interpretations of the Bible and the authority of the church. Because we've got a figure that we can start with and point to as the father of science in many ways.
Modern science, for sure. Yeah. I don't, there were certainly ancient Greek classical thinkers who were thinking in the realms of science, but modern science, I don't think paleontology can be older than modern science. So we can't go beyond or earlier than Galileo in the 1610s, something like that.
Yeah. And I think, it makes a lot of sense in terms of, okay, we've got a starting point, establishing that the earth is not the center of the universe is a good diversion from many of the things that had been established beforehand. And it allows us to put a marker on the timeline going forward. And we can do some bouncing in and out, construct a timeline of some of the key figures. If you were to follow the strands along that contributed to paleo in many ways.
And not only that, after 1610, they come fast and furious, relatively speaking. So if there was nearly 10,000 years from caveman scientist to the modern Renaissance period in Europe, and depending on the science, there were other things that had happened before that, astronomy, algebra, and mathematics, and all those things. In terms of science, modern science did not necessarily begin in Europe. There were a lot of people, but from the formation of the limnology that we're trying to nail down, that's a good place to start and move forward. And we won't have to go very far forward before we start to get into some things that are going to start to look kind of paleolimnology-like.
So then, Galileo should be familiar to most people who've done any study of science, even at the high school level. He basically pointed his telescope at Jupiter, observed the moons, and for some of the conclusions he drew from that, he ended up in house arrest for pretty much the rest of his life due to pushing
for being
back
a heretic. Yeah.
that the sun was actually, the earth was orbiting the sun rather than the other way around. And so that was in the 1610s. So we go a little bit further. Another name that jumps out, when we're constructing one of these timelines, would be the first person to really think of the concept of stratigraphy.
Yeah. And this might be a name that people are not as familiar with the person, but the ideas, absolutely. So Nicholas Steno would be how I would pronounce it. Came up with some of the principles that, whether you think about it or not, if you are a practicing paleolimnologist, these are at the core, geologist or geographer, are at the core of what we do all the time. The three laws or rules of stratigraphy. And they came around in the late 1600s, in 1669 or around there. And that's foundational for everything that we think about.
Yeah. And some of these seem very obvious now, but it took someone to write them down and establish them and, make them obvious to everybody else.
Yeah. So and imagine the time position. Period. Yeah. Imagining the time period that these were, someone who only 50 years earlier said that maybe we're not all the planets are and the sun are revolving around us. And then you're starting to get into fairly detailed geological concepts, like as Adam just said, and I cut him off, sorry, the principle of super or the law of superposition, which is the foundational one of paleolimnology.
Which is the older stuff is overlain by newer stuff. So basically, yeah. The act of sedimentation, as you go further down into the sediments, you go further back in time. And so, yeah, so that in terms of being something written down that can be traced back to goes back to the 1660s.
And the other two laws that Steno put down for stratigraphy may not seem as important if you study recent sediments, but if you're studying old sediments from a geological perspective, which was before people started to take recent sediment cores, was the way many people and most people study lake sediments, are critical as well. The idea of original horizontality, where everything was originally laid down in a flat manner, and then if it's uplifted and changed its shape, that's a process that's occurred since. And then lateral continuity, meaning that sediments that are all deposited in one event or in an event series are going to match up in different locations, even if there are breaks, changes in the horizontality, et cetera. So they're all really important concepts that are still, well, I talk about these in my classes every year.
Okay. So then somewhat parallel to that, or like at least in terms of timing, we'd have Antoni von Leeuwenhoek, who'd be the father of microbiology, who I definitely remember first reading about in like grade 9 or 10 science.
Yeah,
and for he sure. was the first person to basically use, you know, lenses to look at small things, like very small things. So he was looking at, I think it was pond water, and looking at the small single-celled organisms and whatnot floating around and swimming around in just samples of water that he collected from near his house, equivalently, and referred to them as little animalcules. So I think he wrote that in a series of letters and diagrams and whatnot that date back to the 1670s.
Yeah. I think it's suggested that his animalcules were probably rotifers as the like biological group that they belonged to. Yeah. I don't know if he was the very first person to come up with the idea of the microscope. I'm not sure about that, but certainly the one who applied it to anything related to limnology that I'm aware of. And if not the first, then very early, and the ones that we think about.
The first one that recorded it, I guess, in a way that people can trace it back in terms of historically. And then I think this is kind of, in many ways, reminiscent when we're looking at the environmental movement, of like kind of thinking of the timeline and not really realizing how all these things fit together in terms of, you know, the multiple threads. But I think it's interesting that, you know, so geology is starting, if we point to 1669 for Nicholas Steno, microbiology kind of beginning in the 1670s, and classical mechanics being written down and published by Sir Isaac Newton in the 1680s. So like within like 20 years, like those are like kind of foundational text/studies aspects of three very disparate but major elements of sciences.
And disparate geographically, from Italy to the Netherlands to England. Yeah, all over Europe, coming out of the, during the Renaissance, coming out of the whatever Middle Ages, people were writing down critical ideas that just hadn't been explored for thousands of years in some cases, or at all. Yeah, it's unbelievable to think of the time period that must have been at the same time that all of I don't know that Newton was thought to be heretical, but a lot of these ideas were thought to be very, 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 very strange compared to the canon at the time.
I can remember, we're still a little ways away from, you know, a couple of the big ones in terms of really pushing back about, you know, what was described in the Bible. But the next name on my list would be Linnaeus.
Sure, for sure.
So we're talking
can't about name the name, a diatom so. If you don't know how to call it anything.
Exactly.
They'd all just be animalcules 1, animalcule 2.
and
taxonomy.
And my 1 and my 2 might be different from your 1 and
well,
your
exactly. 2. Well, that's exactly the problem.
So it was trying to, the systemization of taxonomy, I guess. Mm-hmm. And what I found was interesting when I was looking it up in terms of binomial nomenclature for animals, it was kind of shows up in the 10th edition of his Systema Naturae in 1758. So
what was in the first 9 editions? What was so interesting in those first, I mean, what I would give for even 9th edition of one of Linnaeus's books, that would be kept under glass. But something obviously was in there that he was publishing many, many editions or what?
But it was like the 10th one where the binomial nomenclature of animals was apparently introduced. And that's the one that was the most
took off.
Most important, I guess, or high profile of his writings.
So I mean, I guess he probably went back and renamed in his new system. I would imagine those are documentations of the things he had seen, and because he was such a cataloger of things that he saw in his travels. So probably 9 plus books of all the things he encountered.
No, it's definitely an evolutionary.
That hadn't come around yet.
No, I know, but you know what I'm getting at. Progression through those editions, but it's kind of interesting that it was the 10th one. It's like,
yeah, for sure,
the big deal. And then there was a name that I was not familiar with at all prior to doing a little bit of reading. I'm sure I may have heard of it in high school, but modern chemistry begins really in the 1770s with, oh man, we're butchering so many of these names, but Antoine Laurent de Lavoisier.
That was very good, I think.
And he, at least according to his Wikipedia page, when you look at like his contributions field of chemistry.
It's a long one, yeah. in the same way that the vast majority of people know who Isaac Newton was. Or many people know who Linnaeus was. And revolutionary in terms of his impact. Coming up with how we name species is a fairly small idea, whereas de Lavoisier, I couldn't even believe the number of different contributions broadly across chemistry that are fundamental to modern chemistry that he spearheaded and did himself. Probably with students and all those things, but still unbelievable. Just the productivity. It's hard to imagine.
Yeah. So he is largely one of the key figures that pushed it from a qualitative to a real quantitative one. He helped construct the metric system. He's noted for his discovery of how important oxygen is in combustion, because he recognized and named oxygen and hydrogen. He wrote the first extensive list of elements, so like a precursor to the periodic table, and reformed chemical nomenclature in many ways, the same way that Linnaeus did with biological nomenclature.
And he lived when was he working? When were these main changes? Obviously after Linnaeus, because we're going chronologically, but.
Through the 1770s and 1780s.
Wow. So not long after.
Not long after. And he did a lot because he made all these contributions, but only lived to the tender age of 50.
There you go.
So there we have the start of modern chemistry.
Yeah. So we've talked about chemistry, physics. Biology hasn't had its grand moment, though everyone knows it's coming, obviously, on our list. But some foray into it. And then we've talked a little bit about geology, but not in the sense of sort of that foundational start of geology. Those ideas of stratigraphy are really, really important in the laying down of sediments, but sort of the father of, everyone gets the father of moniker, but James Hutton in the late 1700s, is considered sort of the father of modern geology. And then I think there are a few people who kind of get that name thrown about for them, but it was one of the ideas that is would allow you to push into this 10,000 year period. You know, before that, the idea of deep time just really didn't exist. There was no one, even the most advanced scientific minds on all of these topics were putting it in the framework of a young Earth. And the idea of deep time was only something that came around at that point based on his ideas.
You know, and it's interesting when you think of like a lot of contemporaries, earlier than that in the 1780s, but a lot of the pushback would be coming from individuals that were really looking for evidence of like a great flood that shaped the Earth, you know, based and in terms of, you know, basing the age of the Earth in reference to Noah's Ark, for example, whereas Hutton was the one to go, no, well, maybe, you know, if we look at all these strata,
fossils that we don't find anymore, extinction, changing climate, all of those things. You know, maybe Genesis might not be a historical record.
Or a literal one, at least.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's a good point.
Because I imagine a great many of the people on this list would be trying to reconcile those two things.
Oh, for sure. And maybe not doing such a good job.
And struggling in many ways because, their work was basically undermining their faith in a lot of cases.
Yeah, and they were scientists.
And everything that they had been taught.
Yeah, and at the broadest sense, they were swayed by evidence. And the evidence said that what was taught broadly might not be the case. And therefore, they came up with new theories to explain it. And that's it. There's the process done. You get deep time. Easy for me to say, sitting here in 2020.
Yeah, and so we're like, what? Almost 250 years later. And it's not universally accepted.
No.
You know, so it's still not there. I guess, you know, it's gone from which side of the scale is the heretical one, I guess, in many ways. Consensus has not yet been reached and probably won't be in our time. And continuing with that, in terms of,
that's a good segue, actually, to the most vilified single person on that topic, one C. Darwin.
Well, to this day, although, he was not placed under house arrest for his entire life.
No, that's true.
Inquisitors.
Yeah, Victorian England was a slightly different place from Italy in the early 1600s.
And to pronounce the name, referring to Charles Darwin, whose seminal work on the origin of species was published in 1859. And
not that well cited, as we've explored. Yeah. But
and he does not have a verified email address to link his publication record to. The book is largely based on his observations made while he was on the ship, HMS Beagle?
Yeah. There's one. I know this is not a video podcast, but I have a model of it on the shelf behind me.
How much earlier was, because the voyages took place while he was a young man and he published it as an old man. When were the actual voyages of the Beagle? That were like the relevant voyages of the Beagle?
1831.
Okay, so, we're up to the 1850s on this timeline, and we're now at kind of the beginnings, but like a huge kind of sea change in terms of biology.
And we had a big gap there, from 1785 to 1859. That's sort of the revolution, you know, the revolution in France, and the American Revolution had just ended, and there were a lot of societal changes in that time period. And just the same way we were talking about the conservation movement, and when you go into these big political and military upheavals and that sort of thing, and the Napoleonic period is all through that time period, these things kind of fall away a little bit. It's hard to do science when armies are storming across Europe, getting into pitched battles. So I'm sure we've missed important figures in that almost 100-year time period. But from the story, you know, when you get back into it, and whether you say the beginning of Darwin's time period or the early 1830s, which would also be the time that some of the people that really influenced him, like Lyell and some of the other, particularly geologists, were working. After that, you know, it's only 170 years and you're right where we are here. So it comes really quickly at that point.
Yeah. Like, I'm over here, 20 years past the Human Genome Project. So within 140 years,
yeah, exactly.
Go from the theory of evolution to the mapping of the human genome.
Mm-hmm.
And I think another thing
staggering.
That's interesting. Yeah.
That's a staggering time frame.
Yeah. Another kind of interesting tidbit to all this is in terms of the hesitancy to publish, because they were so provocative, these ideas, too, even in the midst of these societal changes. So, like, I think the idea of evolution had been stewing within Darwin for decades, but he was prompted to publish after reading some work of a young scientist named Wallace, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he's like, oh, I've got these.
They almost got scooped.
You're going to scoop me.
It's a much bigger name.
That with.
Decided to co-publish them at the Royal Society. And, you know, he's the one who's, I mean, not that Alfred Russel Wallace isn't well known, but he's not a household name for many people. So, interesting.
I mean, you compare that, though, with, I'm going to go off the list and throw out Copernicus here, who also was a key figure in establishing like the heliocentric nature of the solar system. I'm pretty sure that, you know, all of his stuff, you know, was sealed and not to be published or released with anyone until after his death.
Yeah.
Because he just didn't want to deal with the consequences that would come from the spreading of these ideas.
Well, they knew how controversial their topics were in their own time, and how much, and I don't know whether it's upheaval or just discussion would come from it, that that it was gonna cause changes. So we're at Darwin. Okay, so it's probably post Darwin. I think if we're coming as paleo language, we're getting closer now.
Getting closer and closer. So I guess
within 100 years. Time window now, I guess. Very close.
So we get into like the founding of limnology itself.
Oh, here we go. Perfect.
So the study of fresh waters could be potentially dated into the 1890s and like a starting point of like the study of Lake Geneva done by François-Alphonse Forel.
Right. So if you go to SIL's website, the Society of International Limnology, this is where they start their story, the work of Forel to put all of his energy into studying Lake Geneva and the big lakes in France and Switzerland.
And yeah, so jumping ahead a little bit, so SIL, so we'd go from his work to his work in terms of the founding of SIL. That wouldn't happen until the 1920s, but still staying in the late 1800s. Radioactivity was discovered in the 1890s. That is kind of important in terms of paleolimnology for things like dating, which are critical. And that was discovered by Henry Becquerel.
Henri.
1896. Oh, I've been trying with these names. It's not Henry. Henri Becquerel. Hank?
I'm going to guess no.
Didn't go by Hank Becquerel? Okay.
But there's a term that again, many people know the unit, because Becquerel's a scientific, the SI unit for radioactivity. but and obviously, you know, they're all people, they're named after people, but it shouldn't, and so it shouldn't be surprising. But yeah, 1896, that's not that long ago.
And this comes up fairly often, or at least when you think of like the acid rain debates, in terms of things that are not that old, the idea of the pH function as a measure of acidity, you know, didn't first emerge until 1909, so just a little bit more than 100 years ago, and it was work of Soren Sorensen.
I don't actually know anything about him and what his background would have been that he came up. Was he a mathematician? I mean, it's a logarithmic scale, so you get this kind of idea. Is he a chemist? But it is certainly important for a lot of the modern, well, just studying limnology. If you can't, it's hard to think of a chemical analysis that you carry out more fundamental than pH. And from a paleo perspective, a lot of the things we've talked about and probably we'll talk about in the future on whatever part 3 or 12 of this story will deal with that too. So that, I think that's a good point.
Yeah. And and sort of like was first like as an idea developed in 1909 in Polish, but the modern pH function as we know it today was only finalized in 1924, so not even 100 years ago. So again, that's something, you know, that's interesting to keep in mind when you're looking at like pH transfer functions established going back hundreds of years. It's the only way you could get those measurements because the measurement itself was only developed less than 100 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. No long-term, well, there's probably no pH measurements from Lake Geneva in the 1890s when Farrell was first doing his work. Was probably, I don't really know a lot about the background there, but I imagine it's more biological than chemical in its nature. So there we go. We have...
not quite. We've got one last stop on our list of grand old men.
Yeah, it's all men.
Of course, you know, looking at the time period that we're looking at of... that is not very surprising. And it would be G. Evelyn Hutchinson as the father of ecology. And I'm going to put like a date for his seminal works, at least in regards to our discussion today. It would be the Treatise on Limnology, published in 1957.
Yep, which is a series of books that have all sorts of detail about the physical, chemical, and biological processes occurring in inland waters. And I've never flipped through a full version of them, but they are fundamental to everything that you need in order to think about paleolimnology. So there we go. 1957 with Hutchinson. And Hutchinson we'll talk about, I guess, in the future, because he weaves his way in and out of this story a bunch of times through primarily how prolific of a supervisor of graduate students he was, but can tie to a big number of, a large number of the people who definitely call themselves paleolimnologists.
Yeah. And so, yeah, 1957. And so within 10 years of the Treatise of Limnology being published, we had there was the first meeting of the international, or I'm not sure it was called it then, but what would become known as the International Paleolimnology Association.
Mm-hmm. A meeting of people thinking about that sort of thing. So there we go. We've narrowed it down from 10,000 to 10 years. And we have a small window that we need we'll never be able to put a point on. But that's not bad. And interestingly, that's pretty, you know, pretty recent.
Yeah, no, it's very recent. And, you know, like so many things really, it's like cultural, like in the aftermath of World War II, development of universities, like it's all, in many ways, everything on this list is very societal in many ways. So I think that's a pretty good timeline to go from, you know, the development of modern science through to the subdiscipline of paleolimnology, with like a bit of a greatest hits list in terms of key contributions and the, some of the giants that many, many other people have stood on the shoulders of to get where we are today.
Sounds good to me. Yeah. I think that's an interesting history. And to think about, you know, not only is it sort of a search for all of these different, search for this definition, this time period, but it is a bit of a weaving through of all the bits that go into this synthetic science. Yeah.
But I think, you know, like kind of like skip through the elder days is a pretty good place to end part one.
I agreed. Yeah. If not, this will be a 3-hour journey. And I like the Lord of the Rings reference there. That was nice. And yeah.
And so where do we go from here? Well, eventually, I guess in the next episode, we'll go taking a look at, I'm not sure at what point we'll run into someone that actually described themselves as a paleolimnologist.
Yeah. I think the next episode, and I think the next episode is probably, that was a good place to, this is a good place to end for the day. Because it does get a little muddy, to bring the pun in, after that, because a lot of things start happening all at once in different locations, particularly on different continents. You know, there's lots of people working in England and in Scandinavia and in mainland Europe and in the North America, all working on similar things. So we're going to have to kind of try and keep those all in check as we start to weave in the history of the paleolimnologists, as it were.
Sounds good.
Sounds good for a future day. In a couple weeks, we will continue on with this story
and see see if we can build upon John Slidek a little bit more.
Well, I think it'll be interesting for maybe people who don't know, who haven't seen that talk, because a lot of the names we've just listed off are you know, we've gone through a pretty much a Wikipedia surf, as we always do. But as we get into some of the other names moving forward, they probably won't be as well documented online, because they'll have a little more, I don't want to say niche, but a smaller impact on one science as opposed to, you know, the Newtons and the Darwins of the world. So there may be a little bit in there that that's new to some listeners. And if you have any kind of questions or comments or people we've missed that, you know, because I'm sure there are many that could fit into this this framework, you can reach us by a number of different methods. The easiest one is on Twitter at Core Ideas Paleo, P-A-L-E-O. And we will happily try and have a better discussion about social media, which based on our last episode, or two episodes ago now. We're still working on it, guys.
Still working on our Twitter thing. But absolutely, we've missed many people today. Just trying to make a list of things that popped out to us. But if you want to challenge us on any of this and say, you know, your, I don't know how many names are on that list, your, you know, five Rushmores of, you know, foundational paleo scientists is missing X, come at us. Send us some memes.
Yeah, for sure.
We'd love to hear it.
Definitely. Or if you want to, you know, write a very long reason behind that doesn't fit into the Twitter direct message or tweet framework, you can shoot us an email. I don't believe there was anything in the mailbag this week, unfortunately.
Let me check for a second.
Okay, good.
There is nothing in the mailbag. But if you do want to send us something so that one day there will be something in the mailbag, you can write to us at coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. But really, Twitter is the place to be for us. It's the home of SciComm in many ways.
Yeah, that's right. And if there's nothing else, we look forward to continuing on with this story. It's our first multi-parter, which is nice. Something new.
Making a bit of an awkward way to end, because we're not really at the ending.
No.
So until next time, dear listeners.
Until next time, dear listeners. Take care. Stay safe out there. And catch you then.